I cracked it open, and the first recipes were from Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, like the president, vice president at the time. And then there are all these other recipes from state senators and congress people, and they were terrifying. Like, they all just sounded completely insane to me. And they had Jell-O, and there was stuff like Happy Ham and wine jelly, and I was in love, like, right from there.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, I'm speaking with Bennett Ray. Now, Bennett is somebody who has gotten some TikTok fame, and it is for a really fun reason. He cooks recipes from politicians. Now, you're like, what? That sounds kind of silly. But what you'll find is that he is finding all these recipes that are kind of unearthed from church cookbooks and, you know, congressional cookbooks and all these different things. And some of these recipes are just plain strange. Some of them are cool, but a lot of them are kind of nasty. And Bennett just follows these recipes. He looks up a recipe from a 1960s senator and makes it and shares the results. So this is somebody who, back when I had that open call, reached out and wanted to be on the podcast. I watched his TikToks. I watched all the cool things he does, and I knew that I had to have him on. Between just making some of the strangest recipes ever, you know, some Jell-Os with meat in it, and some really, really odd combinations of food, you know, that seems like people from the 30s, 40s, 50s that I guess were politicians really loved their gelatin, and they really loved putting some really odd things in it. But he makes them, he tries them, and he sees whether they're good or not. Sometimes it surprises him. Oftentimes it does not, and it's just as disgusting as it appears. We're going to talk about, you know, I never like to get partisan on this podcast. That's not what it's about. But we're going to talk about which side of the aisle has better food. We're going to talk about, you know, there's been politicians in the past that have been less than ethical, less than savory in their political positions. Does unsavory political positions mean unsavory food, or does the people who, are the worst people cook the best? So we're going to talk a little bit about that, too. We're going to talk about his social media following and, you know, the different series that he does between Cooking with Congress is the series. He's got one that he eats like a certain politician for the day, you know, based on news reports on what they eat. He tries to eat like them. He's done, I think, most of the presidents of the last 20 plus years and few mayors and other politicians. Bennett's a really, really cool guy, just a really cool guy when it comes to the culinary world. He also kind of has a personal quest of trying food from all different countries. So I really, really enjoyed speaking with him. The links will be in the show notes for when you're done listening to this episode to check out all of his social media. If this is your first time listening to this podcast or you haven't already, please go subscribe or follow on Instagram, on Spotify, leave a 5-star review. That helps a ton. But without further ado, here is Bennett Ray. So Ray, how are you?
I'm doing great. How about you, Jackson?
I'm doing really good. Just introduce yourself if you would.
Sure. My name is Bennett Ray. I am the creator behind Cooking with Congress, which is kind of the strangest little niche series and blog about political food. And I basically make the recipes and favorite foods of politicians, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And there's a lot of ugly out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you get the idea for something like that? When I saw that you were, you wanted to be on the podcast, which I appreciate, but I saw that you had created an entire series just around, you know, these politicians' recipes. I was like, I didn't realize that many politicians had recipes. So how did you realize that there was all of these recipes out there and that you wanted to highlight them?
So I was in Seattle with my, I think it was my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and we were at her grandmother's house. She was like early 90s, and just a spry, wonderful lady. She's passed since then. And she, probably nothing, just went into her like library of books and pulled out this one. She said, "Now, isn't this neat?" And just handed me this old cookbook from 1989. It was the 1989 South Dakota Centennial Cookbook. So like 100 years, you know, celebrating South Dakota recipes. And I cracked it open, and the first recipes were from Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, like the president and vice president at the time. And then there are all these other recipes from state senators and congress people, and they were terrifying. Like, they all just sounded completely insane to me. And they had Jell-O, and there was stuff like Happy Ham and wine jelly. And I was in love, like right from there. Cause I just, it was such a serious thing, you know, and yet these politicians were offering these recipes up. They were like, "Yeah, this is what we love. This is what we like. We want to share it with the world." And it felt very, uncalculated in a way, because politicians are so normally calculated in what they're presenting. And it felt like this very innocent presentation of recipes that were not good, most of them. And plus you get those like 1989 headshots. It just was pure gold to me. I'll send you some. Because they are the Coke bottle, like glasses and everything. It looks like the 30-year-olds back then look very different from the 30-year-olds today.
For sure. Yeah. I love those old pictures of like baseball players, you know, in the 80s. And you're like this, and they show a picture. This man is 32 years old and he looks like he's about 65. So yeah, it just totally different for sure. But I feel like you've created a shirt for yourself. I like that you said they were terrifying and I was in love. So maybe that's who Bennett Ray is, huh?
I like that. Yeah, that's definitely been like the kind of ethos behind it. Like, these continue to terrify me. They horrify other people and I love it. And people just keep coming back for it as well. So I was honestly shocked that a lot of folks were into it like I was, you know, that they were surprised by it and loved it. And they were like, into this idea of this theater of disgust, I guess, is kind of the term that I've come up with for it. But that was the first cookbook that I found. And then I dug in, this was like 2017 or 2018. And I went through eBay and Etsy and all these other places and thrift shops and just kept finding more cookbooks, whether they're congressional cookbooks. And so you're looking at kind of the favorite foods of these politicians, or it's campaign fundraisers. People used to do that all the time. They would put out like a cookbook that raised money for the campaign, and it would be a collection from like their fellow colleagues in Congress. And I just thought that was fascinating and feels like something from a very bygone era, right? We're like past that point of like mailer cookbooks or whatever else. So it was cool. It was vintage. And then I discovered that, you know, politicians today are still doing it just in different ways.
Yeah. So what are you, when you're looking for a recipe to feature, what are you looking for? Obviously the crazier ones probably, when it comes to, you know, that the algorithm is going to get more or views, but so do you kind of lean into that direction? Are you making people feel like all these politicians have terrible taste, or do you show some of the good ones too?
That's a great question, because I feel like, you know, people have asked me like, "Oh, you know, you're obviously in the political realm. Are you showing your bias in any way?" And when I've gotten interviewed, they've, you know, by media folks, they've been interested in like, "Well, where do you stand on the political spectrum? Do you have a bias one way or the other?" And I was like, my only bias really is like, I follow what's fun to me. So whether that's going to be something that sounds disgusting, like that's always going to be fun. You know, if it's like, "Oh, it's a ham mousse featuring whipped cream, Jell-O and ground ham." Like, yeah, of course I'm going to try that. Or if it's going to be something really interesting and different, you know, like a take on an ambrosia salad. If you ever had one of those, I'm not sure where you're from, but I'm from like the Rust Belt. And so ambrosia salad, super popular, marshmallows and fluff and all that other stuff, fruits. As long as it's fun, that's where I'm going to go with. That's my real bias, is I aim for the fun stuff. I think that what people take away from it is certainly like, "Oh wow, politicians have terrible taste." And that is sometimes very true. And there's also some stuff that just throughout time, I think they, like, I can't really find a bad pie recipe. 50, 60, 80 years back, they're all pretty great.
Yeah. And just to try to give, you know, these politicians a little bit of an excuse, there's another person, I haven't looked at, I don't know whether they're still doing, you know, these reels or not, but they do recipes from like as far back as they can, you know, 100-year-old cookbooks and from the 1800s. And normally these things are disgusting, definitely like during you know, the Great Depression, people were making things out of, you know, brick crackers or something. So it was all nasty. So I'd like to think maybe these politicians from, you know, the 80s, their cookbook, they grew up during that time, and maybe they just grew up on that stuff, these nasty cookbooks, and that's the reason that they like these nasty things, right?
Totally, like the childhood favorites that you revisit later, you know, like, oh, that's so delicious. I have this nostalgic memory of Jell-O with cottage cheese and pineapple in it. Like, that might be true for some folks. Because I'm sure I've got some stuff that if I tasted it now, like, I'm like, oh, I loved that when I was a kid. And it's not good necessarily, but I still like it because of the memories it brings up. So that could definitely be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've talked to a lot of people in the political world, and I always say before we even start, you know, this isn't a divisive podcast, and I never make anyone, you know, talk divisive. So, but the only question I'm going to ask you, just because it's a fun question, is, you know, you've done a lot of recipes from a lot of different politicians. Which ones are providing the better eats for you? Is it normally the Republicans or the Democrats?
Oh, it's so difficult because I've done them over time, right? Like, I've looked at them from, you know, I made George Washington's eggnog. I've made recipes in the early 1800s, and the parties have changed over time. So it's really hard to track. Even like, if you look at like Democrats, like, well, the Democrats for like the 50s are very different from the Democrats of today. And it's almost a 50-50 split. I would say, even when you go back to like, there's some pretty unsavory, terrible politicians who, you know, voted for things like, there's some awful people who also had really great like chocolate silk pie recipes. So it's not a one-to-one of like bad recipe, bad person or anything like that, or anything sort of black and white. But I really think it's 50-50 so far. I'd say in recent years, I think the Democrats have been more food forward recently. I think that they've like played that up because they realize that's, I don't know, there's some kind of realization of like, there's a part of the culture that's interested in, you know, the bear, right? And there's a segment of their voter base that is very engaged with food in a different way. And so I think they played it up, and especially like the current presidential campaign, one side is playing up food a lot and the other side is like not really touching it. It just doesn't hit with their base as much.
Yeah. Well, I don't know the foodie side of these the politics. So, you know, you said in this current campaign, so, you know, people who are listening, obviously, I think we're talking about the 2024 campaign, Kamala Harris, Donald Trump. I assume you're talking, so there's recipes out for Kamala Harris?
Totally, yeah. She actually had a show on YouTube back in 2019 called Cooking with Kamala. And so she had like Mindy Kaling on there and Tom Colicchio and some other chefs. And so she knows her way around a kitchen. I was talking to the LA Times about this too. Like, it's very clear that she's adept at this and knows how to cook and cook well. And so they're playing into that pretty effectively, I think. I went to school for politics, so I feel like I could comment on that a shred at least. And the Trump campaign hasn't really focused on food all that much, except in the way that like all campaigns focus on food is like, hey, we're going to go stop at like, you know, a barbecue joint and smile and eat spare ribs or whatever.
Yeah, stop at donut shops and have a great conversation, right?
Yeah, great conversation or really awkward conversation.
Right. Now let's talk about the fun parts. Let's actually start out with the strangest things. And I've watched some of your reels, and there's some weird ones. I mean, just recently you posted one about, was it an asparagus in Jell-O, which, I mean, some of these are not weird. Some of these are, and I hate like to kind of, you know, say things are nasty or disgusting because everyone's different, but asparagus in Jell-O, I feel like everyone should be able to be like, that's pretty nasty. So talk about some of the weird ones.
Yeah, I think it's easy for, like, when I first started on the project, I was like, oh, this seems gross. And then I realized that I couldn't really judge it until I tried it. And that was why I started trying this, you know, and started to cook them, because sure, it might sound wild, but a lot of foods sound bizarre that are delicious. Like, and I've eaten a lot of foods that people would say are strange. Like, I grew up in, you know, Pennsylvania, suburban, rural areas. And like, my dad's a hunter, like a primitive hunter. And I know this is getting off target a bit, but, you know, I've tried some strange stuff from there. I've like eaten possum and raccoon and squirrel. And those are things that people would say, like, that is objectively gross or strange. But the way I had it prepared when I was a kid, I was like, oh, this is actually pretty good. So having to actually try the dishes is really important to me. That said, it did confirm many times that I think this will be gross. Tasted it. This is gross. I think some of the weirder ones are when they do a Jell-O salad and then they freeze it. Like, there's something about the texture that happens when they're like, what if we froze mayonnaise? And I don't know if anyone's ever thought of that since then. I'm not sure if it was kind of like a lead paint situation, like that's where some of this came from, or asbestos being everywhere back then. But those are some of the most disturbing ones to me, are that they make a Jell-O salad mixing savory ingredients like asparagus, like mayonnaise or cottage cheese, and then they stick it in the freezer to kind of undo all of the gelatin aspects, and the texture is very upsetting. It's like nails on a chalkboard, but for teeth. It's like teeth on a chalkboard. It's really tough to get through. I think the Jell-O ones are certainly the ones that stand out the most, because it's such a lost art form to make, I think, a good Jell-O salad. And people don't really engage with Jell-O that much, except in shop form today, right? That, or maybe like pudding or something fun and simple, but they don't engage with Jell-O in a, a savory way anymore. And so those tend to be the ones where, whew, they're rough to get through.
Can you think of any that you said you'd be able to confirm, yeah, this looks disgusting and it tastes disgusting as well, but have you been able to try something that you did think was going to be awful that wound up good that you can remember?
Absolutely. The most recent one was actually one of Jimmy Carter's favorites that I looked at, and I was like, this is just like raw onion mixed with mayonnaise and cheese into this big ring mold. It's called a Plains Special Cheese Ring, and a lot of black pepper. And I was like, this can't be good. It's just cheese and mayonnaise. It's cold. It's not like cooked. It's not mixed together. It's just formed into a ring, and then you dip a cracker into it. Or, as the instructions said, you can just eat it with a spoon and strawberry jam. And the first bite I took, I was like, this is really weird. And the second bite I took, I was like, this is growing on me. And then half the ring was gone by the end of the day. So that's how it happens sometimes, where like I'll have that initial kind of like, I don't know, this doesn't taste great. But you come around to it after a couple. It's like, an acquired taste, but sped up intensely, instead of like, oh, it took me a few years to like coffee. Like, no, it took me a few minutes to like the Plain Special Cheese Ring.
I like it. I'm preaching the choir here, but I like that you said, that first bite you weren't sure about, but the second one you like, you at least give it a few bites, because anything I feel like that you think is going to be nasty, the first bite I feel like is going to be nasty. That happens all the time, where I try something I don't think I'm going to like. The first bite, I'm like, ugh, yeah, I don't think so. And then let me try it one more time. Kind of now I've gotten over the shock, and you're like, it's actually not that bad. You've got to get past that first bite of your preconceived notions.
I believe that fully in a lot of aspects of life too. I mean, how can you know if like a TV show is going to be excellent after one episode? Sometimes they nail it, and sometimes you're like, there's enough here, I should at least stick around for a minute. And maybe it takes like three or four episodes and they hit their stride, or a season or something. So I think patience, and also just investigating what you're like you said, your preconceived notions are, your like preconceived biases about like, well, that's not my kind of food, that's not my kind of scene. You're like, well, try it out. You have to give things a chance, I think, to settle in there, because sometimes, yeah, that first dip is not going to be great, but it does grow on you.
What about the opposite way, where you talked about how, how nice the politician is doesn't necessarily say how good their food's going to be. Do you ever, try this bigot senator's cheesecake and you're like, man, I wish this was gross, but it's absolutely delicious?
There was one. I haven't posted it yet, but there was one that I didn't think it was going to be gross, but I was, because he was a pretty reprehensible senator. He was a segregationist who was still like serving in the early 2000s, which is like a Strom Thurmond, if you remember him at all. But the fact that like he was, he like voted against desegregation in the 40s, hardcore did, and then was still serving, in the early 2000s, to me, I was like, that's wild. And I made his French chocolate silk pie. And I was like, man, he is a racist. He like an avowed racist, but man, he can make a chocolate pie. That's, so I was like hoping, I was like, well, maybe there's something that ties it together. No tie in at all. He just is both things, they contain multitudes. And he may have had some really unfortunate and despicable policy views, and he knew how to create a French chocolate soap pie that I would serve to other people without telling them, you know, where the recipe's from.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned how your at the time girlfriend, now wife, has kind of been around since the inception of this idea. Does she get involved? Are you feeding her these Jell-O molds and she's eating them with pleasure too, or does she let you you handle all that?
She will. I think most of her experiences are to walk into the kitchen, open the fridge, and be like, "Oh my God," and I'll hear it from the other room, like, "Oh no, what is this?" You know, that's her experience with it. She doesn't do the Jell-O stuff. She's pescatarian, and a lot of Jell-O is made of, it's not, you know, it's made of animals, at least the collagen, right? So she's not into eating Jell-O, which kind of nixes about 40% of what I make. And then the rest, she'll try it if I'm like, it's really, really good, trust me. Like, she'll try that like 80% of the time. But otherwise, she steers clear. She knows what it's about. It's not usually for her.
How are you in the culinary world outside of this? Do you strictly only make, you know, politicians things, or are you actually a good cook outside of this world?
I think actually the project has made me a better cook in general. So I started doing this years ago and I was like decent. I like knew my way around flavors, but I didn't really have a lot of like cooking techniques or background, no culinary experience. My culinary experience, if you want to call it that, is actually in like making cocktails, mixology, et cetera. Ran a bar program and cocktail menu at a distillery for years. Was kind of a hobbyist cocktail maker at home. That's like my party trick now, is like batch a cocktail and bring it to every party I go to or if we host. So that's really where my experience lies. I have become a better cook though, for sure. Like, we did a project in the pandemic because we couldn't go anywhere. We had to figure out fun things to do at home. So my wife Elise and I, we decided like, let's just cook a different country every, I don't know, week or so. And we did that. We cooked like 56 countries now, I think, at this point. So like, made it through a lot, and we randomized it too. So we weren't just like picking all the, you know, like, oh, France and Italy and India, like all the ones you can just find a great restaurant. We did food that was a little harder to find, at least like the ingredients were tougher to find. And that was really fun. So I think that made me a better home chef. I would not ever call myself a chef. I think a home chef is about the peak of what I can do unless I decide to like go to culinary school. But this has taught me a lot about, it's taught me a lot about how to make Jell-O, but it's taught me a lot about just kind of the basics too, and how to read recipes, how to interpret recipes too, especially older recipes that like, they assume you're going to put salt and pepper in your dish. They're not going to add that in. And older recipes will also be like, well, of course you're going to put baking soda in. Like, it was made at the time for homemakers who would know this sort of stuff. So the recipes were much more spare. Sometimes there's no measurements. Sometimes there's no temperatures, you know, for the oven. It's just kind of like, put it in until it's brown. Okay, well, I have to now figure out what that means. And so it's been a really cool learning experience.
Yeah, and I'm impressed by you over 50 countries. I love trying, you know, different culinary experiences as well. And I feel like, you know, you asked earlier, you didn't know where I am. I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana. So not the mecca of flavor, but we have a lot of different, you know, restaurants from Middle Eastern to Indian to, you know, we have a large Burmese population. So there's some Burmese restaurants. I always like to try all these different countries, see what their food's like, but I can't even, 50 countries is a lot of different culinary experiences. I assume a lot of them are overlapping a little bit, but yeah, I can't even imagine that. I think that's really, really, really awesome for sure.
Yeah, the Polynesian countries kind of overlapped a good bit. And you could see like the great, like we were super nerdy about it too. We like made a spreadsheet and stuff to like remember what we cooked. And we're like, how was this? Was this good? Was this not? Like, it was very nerdy. But we've kept it going like now, you know, 4+ years. The rate is a lot slower. So we're like, oh, okay, like we'll do like one a month now versus like we were doing one a week for sure back in the pandemic when we had more time. But you could also see like, oh, we got better at cooking throughout this. Like, our first recipes were like, didn't really know what we were doing as much. And we attempted some things that didn't work out, and it wasn't the country's fault. That was our fault. So now we see like, oh, okay. More recently, we've just been able to actually execute these at a higher level, which is cool.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's really awesome. And I want to kind of get back to something you were mentioning earlier, and that's about, people asking about, the political side of things. And what I have, the question I have about that is, you said you've been doing it for a while, and I feel like, even 10 years ago, something like this wouldn't even necessarily be looked at super political. It's just fun. Oh, we're looking at politicians' recipes. People wouldn't even want to make it divisive. But unfortunately, in the world we're living in now, if there's a way to make things divisive, people are going to do it. So how exactly do you navigate kind of the, I guess, literally people bringing up the temperature on, your recipes that you're trying to find the correct temperature for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that oddly enough, and we get it sometimes, like there's like, two people. I ate like a president. I ate like Joe Biden for a day. I ate like Donald Trump for a day. Those are my two most popular and viewed TikToks and videos across all platforms. And the people argue, certainly. But there's usually just like a couple people going like 50 comments deep on one particular comment and replies. And it's like typical internet argument and chatter. I steer clear of all that stuff. And honestly, like the most divisive stuff, though, for me, like they're not coming at me for that usually. What they'll come at me for is like, hey, yo, like Fig Newtons are a cookie. How dare you say Fig Newtons are not a cookie? And I've got more like heat for saying angel hair pasta is the worst pasta than anything political. So I think like, I was surprised that like the controversy was not about like, oh, about Joe Biden or about Donald Trump. Like everyone's kind of on the same page of just like, whoa, that's a crazy diet or whatever. Like the controversy is when you have a food take at all. Like that is the riskier thing in some weird way, at least in my space, is like to have a food take, that's hotter than having a political take. Because like I don't feel this way. I'm a political nerd. A lot of people I know follow politics. Most people don't follow politics that closely. Everybody engages with food. And so to have a food take is going to like hit a wider audience and it's going to bring more people in that way.
Yeah. Well, I'm heartened by the fact that people are more enraged by the Fig Newton debate than the political take. I think that's a good thing. I like that for sure. I want to ask you, in order to be successful in something like this, you do have to kind of cultivate a good audience. How do you interact with your audience?
That's a great question too. I kind of through a lot of different platforms. I love the comment section. Like I know a lot of people at first when I was getting into this, they're like, don't pay attention to comments. You might get some hate and some love. And I took it personally when I got, like a couple, like one comment that was just like, oh, I don't like this. And I was like, oh, brutal. How do I make this person? How do I win them over? And eventually I got past that, and it was just like, actually, the comment section is fantastic. That's where like, there's a lot of wit there. There's a lot of clever comments. There's a lot of smart people. I've learned things from the comments too, like the reasons why like certain recipes didn't taste as good. They're like, oh, actually, you know what? I learned something like about cheese, like shredded cheese versus sh like shredding your own fresh cheese. Like, well, that might be why it didn't melt as well under the broiler. Like if you didn't fresh shred your own cheese, like, thank you, commenter. Like, why is this dish called, I hope I can say this on your podcast. The dish is called cracker ass. And it was just like a cheese dip, basically. And you dip crackers into it, had peppers and other stuff. And I was like, why is it called this? And a commenter was the person who was like, there's this dish called eggs a la Caracas. And it might have been just like a hillbilly version of that. And that's like totally where it came from, but I had to ask the internet to find that out. So I like engaging with viewers because they know a lot, and they're coming from all over the place. There's people who love history who are bringing historical knowledge. There's people who love politics who are, just bringing their own facts and figures. And there's people who love food who are better chefs than I am, who are helping me become a better chef for the series. So I like to engage in the comments, and I like to get in there across. Now, Substack I've just started as well, which is kind of a growing community, and TikTok. I find it funny too. Like they make me laugh, and I think I present these in a way that I'm not judging the politicians, essentially. I'm like letting the food speak for itself. Obviously I'm reacting to the food, but then everyone else can say whatever they want. And that's kind of the beauty of the platform, is like I let everyone else kind of dig in and be I don't know, the comedic heroes there.
Yeah, no, I like it. I think you've got to just you've got to look at it all with a grain of salt and just a touch of humor, or it will make you crazy. I love reading the comments, definitely the mean ones, just because people just put so much thought into these mean comments sometimes that you're just like, come on now. I had a comment literally yesterday on, a TikTok reel that it made me laugh because they could have easily just said, this is a terrible podcast. That's just nothing. But they have to put so much thought into it. They said is they need to raise the cost of podcast microphones so people like this cannot record podcasts. Like, that's very interesting take on just saying you don't like the podcast. They need to raise the cost of podcast microphones. I just think, where do people come up with this stuff? It just makes me laugh.
That's devious, yeah, devious and cruel. Like raise the cost of podcast microphones. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like a creative way to do it, but also like spend your creative energy somewhere else. I guess spend your
Yeah.
creative energy building something. I think
Yeah.
that's more fun.
I like it. It makes me laugh for sure. So I guess where are people going to find your stuff? You just talked about Substack. You talked about TikTok. Talk about where people are going to find Cooking with Congress.
Yeah, so TikTok is where I have the biggest following. So you're going to find it, at Cooking with Congress. No G in there. It's cooking, kind of old school. And you're going to find me on Instagram. I just started the Substack recently. So that's where I get to do cocktails with Congress, and kind of bonus content that's not going to be anywhere else. It's free at the moment. Maybe one day, do paid subscriptions. But I just want to get out there and connect with as many people as possible. And then at the website, so cookingwithcongress.com. I'm posting recipes once or twice a week, and you can go on there. And if you, for some reason, are like, "No, I've got to make Richard Nixon's ham mousse," then you know where to find it.
What does the future hold for it all? You just talked about Substack just got created, but what can people look forward to?
My goal, so I like had this insane goal. What it felt like an insane goal last year, I was like, "I want to be on TV talking about Cooking with Congress," like last year at a certain point, and that came true. Which was really amazing. And I felt very lucky and fortunate for that. And I really want other people to start tasting this stuff. I don't want to be the only one eating these things. I want to start bringing on people who are funnier than me, smarter than me, more politically engaged or connected than me, I guess. Like if we bring on congressmen, comedians, whatever else, I want them to start tasting this stuff. And my goal, like I would love to be feeding, horseradish jello to Jimmy Kimmel. I think that would be an ideal scenario for 2024, 2025. So the hope is that we just keep getting out there in this kind of political season and really just grow and connect with more people and keep it fun.
I love that. I was at lunch before our conversation. My wife said I had to ask you if you got one recipe from all of this that she needs to make. What's the recipe that you suggest people?
Ooh, okay, so it was one that I thought was going to be kind of funky, and it turned out to be absolutely delicious. So it's Kika de la Garza's coffee gelatin. So the name is super, it's boring, right? So it's coffee gelatin. That is what it is, right? It's essentially espresso infused jello, but you layer it with this rum infused whipped cream, and it creates this almost like deconstructed tiramisu flavor. It's delicious and it can look really elegant. Coffee jelly is a thing in Japan. They eat a lot of coffee jelly there, and so kind of connects with that. But that was a surprise recipe that I like remember to this day. I would totally serve it to like guests. That's how proud of it I am, and highly recommend.
Gotcha. Well, again, tell people how they're going to find you, shout out all your connection points.
For sure, cookingwithcongress.com is the website. You can find me at Cooking with Congress, no G in there, on TikTok, Instagram, and now Substack. And hopefully, you see me one day on late night TV.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jackson.
Besides Bennett Ray, really enjoyed that. We learned the answer to the question, does bitter politicians make bitter food? Does sour views make sour food? The answer is no, not necessarily. You've got to sweeten the pot, I guess, with all of those terrible ideas. And that's exactly what happens sometimes. Some of the best food are by the worst people. I hate that that's the case, but that's what the survey shows. So really, really fun conversation. You know, people just ate differently back in the day. It seems odd to us now, but not always as odd when it comes to the time people were living. Obviously, gelatin molds and the food there kept longer when people didn't have as much access to refrigeration or, you know, keeping things preserved, and had the Great Depression in there. We had times that we just needed to get cheap food. All these things sometimes contribute to some really strange combinations. But yeah, I thank Bennett for trying those out for us all, so we don't have to. Urge you to check out his social media where you can see him making them. You can see him trying them. A lot of times you can see him not liking them. You can also go check out how he feels about eating like some of, you know, our country's past presidents. Some of them eat better than others. I think you can probably guess some of them, but some of them surprised me myself as well. So just a really cool guy to follow. So all the links to his information will be in the show notes. Everything's cooking with Congress, and the cooking is basically without that G. All the links will be there, TikTok and Instagram and all that. I urge you to check him out. For sure. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, or you haven't already, go follow us as well. Not Enough Podcasts on Instagram, Not Enough Podcasts on TikTok, Not Enough with Jackson Epp on Facebook, JacksonEpp.com. Lots of places to follow along. You don't miss a lot of great episodes coming up, a lot of amazing guests in the past, over 210 of them now. Love for you to check out some of those as well. Go leave a 5-star review on Apple and on Spotify. Helps a ton. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps even more. But if you do nothing else, catch us next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.